Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and I am joined, as always, by the amazing JP. Hey, JP, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing great, and I'm excited for this episode because we're talking about something we've never talked about before, which is...
That's like the exact opposite. Beaten this horse, the dead horse, again and again. So this week is actually... So we are, just a quick reminder, we are covering Refactoring, this Martin Fowler book that's been absolutely awesome, and it covers a lot of great refactoring examples all in JavaScript. And this week, we are talking about Chapter 4, which is all about building tests and writing self-testing code. So here we are getting back up on our soapbox, yelling at you about tests and why you need more tests.
Yes, I guess it's going to be maybe perhaps a little different because we'll try to put testing through the lens of like refactoring. So how does testing fit into the context of refactoring? And the TLDL, the quick little one-liner is you can't really refactor properly unless you have a good set of automated tests.
Yeah, absolutely. What was cool about the way this chapter set up is it made me realize the history and how far we've come with testing because, you know, he introduced, I think it was like in the late 80s or early 90s, the idea of when they were running these tests and figuring out that they could have their code kind of check itself instead of having to manually QA and debug everything. And it was such a novel and amazing idea that at compile time, you would have the system kind of check itself. And everybody noticed how much their efficiency went up because instead of just kind of writing code, making the changes and praying it works and waiting on feedback from users or feedback in the quality testing, you get it right there immediately when you're writing the code. And essentially, when you have good tests, moving forward to today, I mean, testing is built into every framework, regardless of what language you're using. And we have good self-checking tests. It's just very convenient and easy to run tests in most contexts now, which is just absolutely incredible. I love how far we've come. But when you are wanting to change a piece of code, I think we've all had that feeling of, oh, I don't want to touch this because it's working. Like, I don't want to fuck with it because it's going to break everything. And so when you have reasonable test coverage, that's the missing link that can give you the confidence to know you can start moving around code using some of these techniques that we've been talking through to start to refactor code efficiently, knowing that you are actually improving things, not just making a mess and making things worse.
Yeah, totally. So let's just like dive right into it, I think.
Yeah, that sounds good. So a lot of these examples were all written in JavaScript, as the whole book is, and it uses kind of this Mocha testing library, and it gets really into the weeds about the specific test example he writes. But essentially, he sets up an example, and he starts testing it piece by piece and refactoring it piece by piece, which was really cool. But, you know, I very much believe in testing and write a lot of tests every single day in the context of Ruby and Rails, but I have never actually written a JavaScript test. I do a lot of vanilla.js and some Vue stuff, but unfortunately, at this moment, I don't really test any of it beyond a full integration test, like enabling JS on the... not Capybara, but whatever the headless one is that actually turns on JavaScript and then goes through and clicks through the interface.
Selenium
driver. Yeah. So I've done it that way, but I've never actually written like unit tests for JavaScript, which I really enjoyed reading through that and seeing how that works. But I'm assuming you, JP, you write a lot more JavaScript than me in the React Native land. Do you do like JavaScript unit testing? And can you give us like a quick overview of what that looks like in practice, doing testing on JavaScript?
Yeah, totally. So unit testing and integration testing in JavaScript is very, very, very similar to Ruby. However, I think the reason why you might feel that there is such a huge gap or there is such a huge difference is because you, much like I, are used to writing Ruby tests with the Minitest framework, which Yep. uses the assert style. So it's like assert equals... and then the first argument is like your expected outcome. And then the second argument is like the actual outcome. And then the third argument is potentially like a custom message, right?
Sure.
However, if you use something like an RSpec and you can use like the expect style. In fact, I think Minitest supports the expect style.
I think it does too, yeah.
It's just like two different ways of testing things. So if you use the expect style or if you use rspec, which I think is primarily the expect style, you would find a lot of similarities with the way that JavaScript testing is usually done. I don't think I've ever really have seen too much in practice of assert style in JavaScript. Excuse me. So a lot of JavaScript is mostly just the same. The only difference is that with minitest, it's a method, right? You're defining a method that's the test. Rails Magic gives you a little bit of some syntax sugar so that, like, if you're mm-hmm. writing a minitest, you pass in a block. So it's like test, blah, 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 and then you pass in, like, a do end block, right?
Sure, yeah.
But the only difference is that most of the time in JavaScript testing, if you're using something like a Jest or a Chai or Mocha, I don't know what Chai or Mocha look like under the hood. I use Jest a lot, which I think most people do, which I think is like
I've heard of that one a lot.
Which is like a wrapper around all of like the expect, Mocha, Chai libraries. Is the only difference is that like JavaScript is mainly like function based, so you're just passing in functions. So like you do have like your describe and it blocks, and then the second argument is a function, and the function contains everything. So the function is kind of like the do block that you're passing in a Ruby mini test. I realize that a lot of this, as I say it out loud, sounds like maybe jibber jabber if you don't use Ruby or JavaScript. But all that is to say that it's ultimately really the same thing. You're expecting some value to equal some other value, or you're expecting some input to be some output, whether that's null, undefined, some string. Whereas I guess for you and I in minitest land, the logic is a little bit different, where you assert that you have some expected value equal some actual value, whereas it's like the other way around in JavaScript.
Cool.
It's the same thing. Basically, I'm just saying it's the same thing with a little bit of different syntax. And I actually think that the minitest, I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant here, that I think that the way that you mock and stub in minitest is like very, very confusing. I remember first approaching testing and not really understanding what the hell a mock or a stub is, and why I would ever use them or how you're supposed to use them. And then like I was introduced to mocks and stubs in JavaScript testing frameworks and test runners, and I was like, oh, okay, like I need to like mock some function. Here's how you do it. And it's like you just pass in what you want as the result, and it's like it just mocks it out for you, and it's like, oh, this is great. And then you go back into like mini test world, and it's like you do this weird stub any instance if it's like an instance method, or if it's like a class method, you do just like stub, and then you pass in like a lambda or something, I don't know. It's like very strange, and I have to do a lot of putsing out to the console just to see whether or not this like stub thing is working. And then there's like the stub verify thing and mock.verify, and you're like, what the hell's going on? I don't know. It's very strange, but I think I love minitest, and I love that it's just plain Ruby. You don't really have to like learn.
Know anything.
You don't have
to learn anything. Yeah.
Other than like a couple like helper convenience methods, but that's just like reading the docs, right?
Yeah.
But the whole like mocking stubbing mechanism is kind of weird.
Yeah. But I think in general, it's useful for me to hear when next time I'm approaching wanting to spin up some JavaScript tests, and next time I want to do that. Like I said, I've only really tested JavaScript with integration. So basically something goes through and clicks through everything in a bunch of different cases to make sure that it works. But uniquely with JavaScript, like doing something in Vanilla.js or with Vue, in my past, it's like sometimes it's really hard to mimic a certain action, like drag this slider this way. It's like that's super hard to do with something like Capybara and Selenium, where it's like, click this, set value at. It can be really difficult when you're trying to do that, like interacting with the DOM. And I think it's important that you're actually testing the disparate pieces and different functions within your JavaScript as much as possible. And so it's good to hear that the overall approach is very similar, and I need to think about it in similar ways, in that I am setting up because basically we're talking about mocks and stubs. And if you're not familiar, and I'm going to probably butcher this to some degree, but It's really about setting up the data so that you can then pass it through your function and then check the output. That's all any of this testing libraries are doing at a very high level. So here's the data that I need the state of its data. So like, give me a user who has an invalid email. Now pass that user with the invalid email into my email validator and expect the email invalidator to return false, like the email is invalid. So that's the type of flow that any kind of testing framework follows. And so that's what JP was saying by mocks and stubs and all this different stuff. But it sounds like overall JavaScript testing works pretty much the same way at a high level. And there's a lot of syntactic differences and expects versus asserts and all those different nuances. But overall, we shouldn't be too afraid. And whatever you're working with, there's a way to test it. I did have one specific question about JavaScript testing. And for some reason, my brain gets hung up on this. I feel like I write a lot of JavaScript that does DOM-y things. Like it interacts with the DOM and like makes the page move or grabs elements or finds values. So for some reason, in my head, it's really hard to test UI in that way. So how do you test UI with this approach? I guess like as I'm saying it, I'm realizing like I just need to set up the data, test the function, and test the output. I mean, is it that simple? For some reason, because there is no like UI, it kind of breaks my brain a bit that you can test it in this same way.
Yeah. Okay, so hopefully this isn't like a hand-wavy answer, but I don't really test those things. When I was working on this like this multi-slider UI in React where you can, you know, it's like a bar and then there's like two little dots and you can and drag them and then
like really complex UI interaction for sure.
It creates a range, right? So what I tested instead were the functions where I can give it some input and then return some output and then make sure that those inputs and outputs were giving me exactly what I wanted and needed. Otherwise, you're sort of testing that like the browser's working. I think there's like some degree of trust that you have to have when you're testing something. It's like, how can I test that I'm clicking something? It's like you just have to trust that like that click is going to happen.
Right. That's a good point. And I think there's a big piece of this for me that is still, I mean, I'm only about a year into really embracing JavaScript and some of these newer approaches. Like a lot of things I would build pre a year ago would work perfectly with JavaScript disabled. And it's only been in the last year or so that my shit will break if you don't have JavaScript enabled. And I think it was because I was a little bit afraid of this dark box and this wild west of JavaScript and JavaScript frameworks and some of this stuff. And so I feel like it's hard for me to trust that JavaScript is going to work properly. But I think that's just a part of maturity of not only browsers, but where the industry has gone, and a part of me being comfortable with understanding like, no, there's some fundamental assumptions that I can assume are going to work. Like to some degree, like, yeah, I might have an integration test that checks a button click, but I'm not going to like have a unit test that checks that buttons respond when they're clicked. Like, buttons will respond when they're clicked. So that's an interesting point to make of like how detailed you get in tests and some base level assumptions there. So cool. I think we got into the weeds there a bit, but those are some different nuances of testing we haven't talked through, which is interesting. So I want to talk about TDD for a second, which is test-driven design. And the book had a small like two paragraphs about TDD and just like when to use it and how it was introduced and some of these things. So I'll admit, so for me, I definitely embrace and use TDD, which for those of you who don't know, TDD is basically before you write actual code to add the feature or fix the bug you're wanting to do, you actually write the test first. So first you write the test for the new feature, it expects it to be there, but then the test is going to fail. And then basically you write as little of code as you can until the test passes. And then it's like this back and forth between writing a test first and then writing code and then getting it to pass. So that's what TDD is. And me personally, I rarely reach for TDD. I would say probably about 25%, maybe a quarter of what I write is like done within the TDD framework where I write the test first. What about you? What are your thoughts on TDD?
Yeah, so if you ever hear like this thing called red-green refactor, that's like what TDD is, right? You start with a failing test, red. You make the test pass, which is green, and then you can refactor. And then you have this like tight feedback loop because once you refactor, you have a passing test and you know that if it fails, like then it's actually like a legitimate failure. My thoughts on TDD are super great when you get a bug that comes in through Jira or GitHub or whatever, or a client or your founders yelling at you. a la Justin at WizTutor.
Yeah.
then I had to clarify that. I didn't want that to be like an ambiguous.
Nice. Like, no, I'm talking about you, Justin. I love it.
Then I think it's great to start with the failing test, because sometimes you're like, no, how is that possibly broken? But when you're able to reproduce a bug with a failing test, then it will like give you so much more confidence that you actually mm-hmm. fixed it. And I think that's great. So like, and if you happen to get the test to be like passing in green and the bug is still there, then it's like, oh, maybe I just uncovered an edge case. So I think TDD is 100% perfect for situations like that. And I think that's actually what the book says too. It just feels like a natural thing. But I think in terms of like starting a new feature, it's really easy to be slowed down. And maybe that's just like because I don't TDD enough that it slows me down. But I feel like I really need that like prototyping phase where I just like get something on the screen and like get some initial work done.
Tracer code, I think we've called it
yes,
in the past.
Tracer code. Shout out to Pragmatic Programmer. But it feels really okay, it's not hard. It's really easy to go from tracer code to like not writing any tests, which I'm mm-hmm. definitely 100% guilty of, to writing tracer code to like, you know what, that's good enough. My tracer code is actually not tracer code, it's production code. And then I'll tack on some tests later. But, you know, there's like trade-offs too, right? It's like maybe the feature you're working on is it's like so incredibly like low risk. You're like changing some text or something, some implementation, right? Yeah. That it's like I don't really need to like write a test for this. Like it feels like absolutely silly. And I think this is a really good quote worth mentioning about testing, and I think maybe I'm cherry picking this for my argument. However, I think it provides some pretty good insight. So here's the quote. It's, testing should be risk driven. Remember, I'm trying to find bugs now or in the future. Therefore, I don't test accessor methods that just read and write a field. They're so simple that I'm not likely to find a bug there. My focus is to test areas I'm worried about going wrong. And so I think that's a really good pragmatic way of thinking about it. And sure, you can argue that like the really easy things are like the easiest things to test. So you might as well like TDD them because it's like a quick and easy win. But at the same time, it's like, is this thing really going to break? Like, is this accessor method that's literally just grabbing a field?
Right.
Is that worth testing? Maybe I don't really need to TDD that. I could just add that feature in and then maybe add a test later. Yeah. Like doesn't
And also
have
there's
to be
this
first.
Concept of if your adder accessor isn't working, whatever your getter methods aren't working, then the other tests will fail. Like
right.
to some degree, like you can depend on, well, if that includes that function and we're testing the broader function that includes the sub function, then sometimes there isn't a reason to test the sub function. I think specifically, you're totally right. I reach for TDD in the same way when there is a bug and I'm trying to fix the bug. That is totally when I reach for TDD, especially because like practically like going through your localhost browser to recreate the scenario over and over to see if you've solved it is just incredibly inefficient. It's like, oh, it's on step two in this specific case. And like, I have been that person though, who's spent probably two more hours than I needed to, because I just refused to write a test because I was stubborn and immature in my coding journey. And so it's way easier to just set up this failing situation. And it can be actually easier to set up the specific case when you're getting that specific bug or failure, when you approach a bug fix with TDD, and then you know that bug's not going to happen again. That's why like it is so the best approach. And I think the other time when I TDD is when I'm also trying to refactor something specifically. So I'll write a little bit of extra test coverage in certain areas to give me a higher level of confidence when refactoring. Since we're talking about refactoring, I'll throw that out there that I will write more tests first. Like if I'm sitting down to refactor a piece of code, I'll write a couple more tests against it first often before starting to monkey with it too much, especially if the coverage is a little bit laxed. I liked one of these quotes that he had here, which is basically, quote, it is better to write and run incomplete tests than to not write or run complete tests, unquote. So basically, just write tests, even if it's a little bit, like a little bit of testing goes a really, really long way. Because like I was just talking about with JP, if there's a function that calls another function or a method that calls another method, and you test one of those, like you are not 50% there, you potentially could be 100% covered in those things. So don't assume because you don't have the time to write every single edge case in every single scenario. Like, write what tests you can. Any coverage is better than no coverage, for sure. It's like, yeah, it's just any coverage is better than no coverage. That's the way I'll say that. But on that subject, like oftentimes we can write tests that only cover a very specific happy path, that kind of just cover the exact perfect scenario, perfectly formatted data, the exact, you know, situation, no one reloading the page between filling out the form, like those types of things. You know, it's easy to test only happy paths. So I want to talk about this idea of the boundaries of our tests and pushing outside of that happy path a little bit. And I know you had some thoughts on that too, JP.
Wait, can I ask a question first about...
Of course.
I want your opinion on something in the context of, on the topic of refactoring and TDD. I want to know if you consider this TDD, and you alluded to it a little bit, is that you said you TDD when you're refactoring, and... Can you only TDD when you're not refactoring, like when you're starting something new? Okay, so hold that thought.
Yes, I think technically you're right, but I want to hear what you're saying here.
Because, tell me if this is TDD. So I was in a similar scenario, so let me paint the picture for you really quick. Is we have this, you know how in a Rails project you have a scripts folder, and you could and you could just add scripts to that, and then you can run it with like Rails R and then the script path. So we have... I had a ticket recently that I had to take one of those scripts, and it was just like a bunch of Ruby code. I was like tasked to basically refactor that into a class so that we could test it, because it was just like kind of in the wild, wild west. So the first thing I did was I basically took that whole script and then I just threw it into a class as like a one really long method called like generate or perform. And then from that script file, I like called that class dot perform, right? And then so like I can just like go, I can just assume that the script is working as is, you know, that's like a safe assumption I can make. So from there, I wrote tests against that because like obviously I needed to do a little bit of refactoring. I can't just have one method that called generate or run or perform.
Yeah.
So I started writing tests against that, and I started like breaking out some of the things that were basically just getters. And then I would like write tests against that. And then once I had this like solid set of tests where I can like expect that some value equals some value, then I started like actually like refactoring it and like breaking things out into like much smaller methods that I could like actually read, and you could tell like what's going on. It was like creating a CSV, pushing to the CSV, and then like saving the CSV somewhere, right?
Sure,
and then
sure.
So like then I was able to like refactor based on the test that I initially wrote. So is that considered test-driven development? I don't know.
I think probably to a lot of pedantic specific people, probably not. My broader definition of TDD is writing a test before code. That's like my broad definition of TDD. If I'm writing a test before I go and actually write the code that fulfills that purpose, I kind of put in my mind that I'm doing TDD, which is a very, very loose definition and wouldn't hold up on Stack Overflow, I'm sure. But I think to add a little bit of nuance to what you were saying, you know, the idea of migrating the script into his class, I think if you wrote the test for the class first and then it was failing and then started importing it, that would be more TDD.
Okay. Because
kind of in both of our examples, when I was saying that I will kind of quote TDD, I'm using that term loosely, when refactoring, I'm just meaning I'm writing tests first. But I think TDD specifically, you have to have a red part of your flow. Where in both of our examples, like there wasn't often a red part of our flow. Like in TDD, you should have like 12 failing tests and then 5 failing tests and then 3 failing tests. And you kind of slowly chip away at the failures until it gets green, where we're talking about more of a spectrum and a balance between the two, which is, you know, writing some code, writing a bunch of tests, writing some code, writing a bunch of tests. And it's kind of this middle ground between TDD and then just like waterfall, writing all the code, then writing the tests. I find a lot of value in that middle ground and writing tests before code, but they're not necessarily read, which I think that's specifically TDD. So I don't know if I answered your question. It's also just a matter of opinion, I think. It's parsing terms at this time. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, we're splitting hairs. But I think that's true, is that like if I really wanted to do truly TDD, I would like write a failing test and then slowly migrate the class over.
Right.
Which, you know, there's like some value in not doing that, because it's like I don't need to see a failing test. Like I can be certain that like this code works because it does. Because I said so.
Because you said so. I don't know. You're losing your own argument, JP.
No. Yeah.
Let's talk about happy path and boundaries of testing a little bit. I know that's something that we wanted to push into a little bit. So, like I was saying before, it's easy to only test, you know, the perfect situation with a perfectly handled formatted email with perfect situation. And, you know, that's the only time you test it. You don't test multiple roles or whether they're logged in or logged out or whether they log out in the middle of the flow. Like, all these different edge cases are often not tested. And I think, of course, if you're going to only test one thing, test your happy path. Don't push the boundaries. But as you get into things, you'll start seeing the value in trying to kind of break your shit in your tests. And it's really useful because if you've ever worked with a QA person, a QA team, like, that's what they do. Like, they throw in only 4 digits in the phone number field and they just see what happens and they kind of push and poke at your code. And I think there's a lot of value in pushing the boundaries of your tests and kind of trying to poke holes in your own code. I know you had some thoughts about this, JP.
Yeah, so to take a step back, like an example of a happy path, if you're testing like a login form, would be like, I put in an email, a valid email, and I put in the 6-character requirement password, and then I test that I successfully log in. I create a post request to a session or something like that. Like, I successfully log in, right? But then that's your happy path. So probing the boundaries would be like an example of like, what happens if I put an invalid email where there's like no at symbol? Or what happens if I like, it's just like it's just invalid. Or what if I put in 4 digits? Mm-hmm. Or what if I put in 100 digits?
No password. Yeah.
Yeah. What if I put in no password? What if I put in 1 character for the email? It's interesting because when you probe the boundaries, you might start to find that, like, shit, where are the boundaries? Like, how far can I push this? What if I put in 1,000 characters in the, like, will the input let me do that? What if I put in 1 character for my password? What does it do? What if I put like all numbers? Does it care that I put in all numbers? You know, some password inputs like require some weird like requirement. So I wanted to talk about where you reach for when you probe the boundaries and like what are some instances of where you've been potentially like burned. And so now you know, like, okay, I need to test for this edge case, because I definitely have a couple in my head where I'm like, the only reason I know to reach for these random edge cases and makes me look like kind of like smart on code review is because I've personally been burned by these things.
And so
when I see it, I'm like, okay, look, by the way, you need to account for this. And it's like, oh wow, I never thought about that. And I'm like, yeah, me neither, until like my code like totally broke and everything crashed.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I feel like there's so many different rat holes we could go down with talking about pushing the boundaries of code and like crazy horror stories about not thinking about edge cases. But I think the very basic ones is invalid. So whether that's nil, negative, giant numbers, just invalid data. Like, we often think that data is going to be perfectly formatted, and it's often not. I remember on one of my first Rails projects, because I was trying to learn things and just because of choices, I didn't use any like authentication library. So I wasn't using Devise or anything like that. So I rolled my own authentication scheme, which was great for learning. I would actually recommend that in the early days. But I remember this one specific thing was that my emails were case sensitive. So that means if you signed up with a capital A in your email and then tried to log in with a lowercase a, it wouldn't find the account. So things like capitalization, nil, you know, anything that's invalid format, like something that actually happens in production from time to time is users will put a password in the email field and an email in the password field just because like people aren't looking or paying attention or they tab it wrong. And I've seen that happen before. So like, that's a perfect example of a happy path that, and I think it's important to not lean on your front end validation too hard. Like, you want to know what's been getting submitted to your database is correct and that it is a valid format and that you're validating it kind of at the controller or database level, kind of at the model level beyond those things. So the number one recommendation I would make to short answer is formatting. Like, try to fuck with the formatting, pass in the wrong stuff, pass in the invalid stuff, pass in missing data, and see what happens and how you handle it. So that's the number one recommendation I would say in pushing happy path.
Yeah, I think one thing I typically like look for nowadays is when I'm like looking at code review is like division by zero is like a huge one, because like it will make your whole front end blow up if you don't account for like what happens if I accidentally divide something by zero. And also negative numbers. It's like, for some reason we don't think about negative numbers, but like, especially with UIs, a lot of that stuff is just like a number line at the like underneath the hood, right? So it's like you might have like a range that does include some negative numbers. So what happens when, you know, a slider goes to like a negative value, like a negative x, and it's like, oh crap, I didn't account for that. And all of a sudden, like, my calculation is like super screwed up and UI looks totally broken.
Like, one time I was dealing with a coupon code and there was the idea of like having a credit in a coupon code. It's like, this is $50 credit. So it's almost like a gift card that's one time use. But if your purchase was only $30, then you would actually get $20 back. And like, obviously the company doesn't want to be giving people $20 back. So like, because that's a negative number. So your total of your order would be negative $20. And like, you can pass that to Stripe and it actually will post a credit, at least at the time. So like, that's a really edge casey extreme example of a negative number really screwing with things, because that could have lost the company a ton of money because they could have been paying out credits when in reality their order in that case should have just been free. Like, obviously it shouldn't go below zero. And in hindsight, and speaking of it just like casually, it makes total sense that that's obvious. But when you're writing those tests and when you're writing that code, it's not necessarily obvious that it should never go negative. Like, sometimes you might want to have some kind of account credit balance. Like, that might be the case. But negative numbers are a really big one. And like you said, often in UI stuff, it can really blow stuff up. And I think the other one is like thinking about roles is another big one that I have in tests. So like, you tested the idea of messaging someone as a student, but not as a tutor, like in the case of WizTutor or whatever example you have. Like, this works perfectly as an admin. Have you tested it as this type of user or this type of user or a non-confirmed user? Like, should it work for this type of user? So I think that's a big one. And that's why I think there's a lot of value in like having different, like, I'll call it modules in your tests, like having a folder of this type of user and test all the different interactions for that role for that user. And like, for this user, all the different interactions for that user, which that's getting far too into this, but I think roles is a big one, and testing the different types of roles for different interactions, you know, whether they're logged in or logged out and what those roles look like. And I think another big one for HappyPath is time-based things. So like, we've talked about things being temporally coupled and the idea that something has to happen before the other, but like, what if it doesn't? Like, what if they haven't confirmed their email yet and they go to send a message? Like, in the golden path, they've confirmed their email and then they can send the message. So those are the three ones that I would say that are really always off the top of my head, which is bad data, nil, negative numbers, the idea of roles and who is trying to do this interaction. And the other big one is time-based things. So what happens if I do X before Y, and how does that affect the system? Like, obviously you want things to be not temporally coupled, but you have to have the test structure in a way to catch those types of things. You know, what if you try to make a payment before you have an order? Like, what happens? Like, the system should think about that. It probably shouldn't go through. So those types of things I think are really important to think about when pushing the boundaries of your tests. And you can take this too far. Like, I feel like I dealt with some failures and then I started writing tests for every single role and every single case. Like, it depends. That's always the answer in software.
Yeah, I think a good rule of thumb, and maybe this isn't something that you can apply to everything, but something that kind of works for me is that like the there's a spectrum of the tests you should write. And let's say that the happy path is like right in the middle. Just account for like the extreme negative and the extreme positive. So like, mm-hmm. if the happy path is a positive number, think about like a really, really, really high number. Like, what if you put like a billion in there? What if you put like negative 10? You know, so you have to like, you think about like how things are in the negative and the positive. So like, what if you have a collection of data, like an array? What happens if the array is undefined, or like, yeah, if it's empty? Or what if the array is like totally full and has like a it's like pushed to its limit? So it's just like, look at like where your happy path is, and then think a little bit to the left of the negative on the number line, and then think a little bit to the positive. Like, how does that affect? And I think that's sort of the same thing with roles too, is like, as a regular user, how does it work? What about as a super user, as an admin? And what about like a guest user who doesn't have that much privilege? So it's sort of the same thing, right? Where it's like, look at like the spectrum of things and reach a little bit to the positive and reach a little bit to the negative and see like what your outputs are.
Yeah, for sure. I like the answer that the author put as far as your best measure for good enough tests. So that's what he says here. And the quote is, quote, "How confident are you that if someone introduces a defect in your code, the test will fail?" Unquote. So basically, like, at the end of the day, what you're trying to do is prevent bugs. That's the idea for testing. So that means you don't have to have every situation covered, but, you know, how confident are you that you have the general use of your code covered? And honestly, I'll always reach for the Pareto principle in pretty much everything in life. And pretty much what the Pareto principle states is that, you know, 20% of your effort produces 80% of your results. And I think that's extremely true in tests. You don't need to cover 100%. You need to cover that top 20% of interactions. And that's really going to get you those 80% of results. That doesn't mean 20% test coverage. Don't mishear me there. But I'm saying from an amount of effort, because that's one thing that can be misleading in quote test coverage, like the automated test coverage that tells you like you have 90% of your code coverage, is that all it's checking is that you're running a function or method. It doesn't check the different types and different ways that function or method can be run. So just because you get that test coverage on that function or method doesn't mean you're testing the different cases for that function or method. So that's a really important thing to note and remember that, you know, so when I'm talking about 80% of results with 20% of effort, it's just like this pragmatic thing that comes with experience of how confident you can be that things are failing. I think that pretty much wraps up refactoring and testing. What would you say?
Yeah, I think so. We might have to like not do another episode on testing for
a while. I think we got a ban for at least a quarter, 3 months at least. I agree. Cool. So do you have any picks for this week?
I don't. I think this is like the second week in a row I don't have pick. I wrote a pick down. My pick is taking time off.
Oh, that's a good pick. I like it. I just took a week off last week. I rode my bicycle 462 miles. It was awesome. It was a good time.
That's impressive.
I think if you're listening to this, I've talked about this ride for a long time, but I actually had to cancel the first time. So yeah, I finally did that ride and it was great just being away from a screen. And while I was on that ride, this leads into my pick. I read this book called Make Time. It was a great book. I forgot the author name off the top of my head, but I will make sure to put it in the show notes. But my pick isn't actually the book Make Time, because it was good, not great. It was a solid B+. But there was this idea in Make Time, which is the distraction-free phone. And I linked the Medium article here that the author wrote. And the idea is that he talks about this idea of an infinity pool app, and basically any app that you can just pull the refresh and new shit comes in. So if you can just pull the refresh and you have more stuff coming. So that's Twitter, Instagram, Netflix, like it's endless pools of content. It's very easy for our monkey brains to get lost in these infinity pools. And it's very easy to look up and be like, oh shit, I've just been scrolling Twitter for 45 minutes. And like, I have priorities and things I want to do. So the idea here is you really take ownership of your phone. You really take ownership of your notification settings. You take ownership of what's on it. You remove apps like Instagram and Facebook and Netflix and whatever is the most distracting thing to you, and kind of maybe even set limits on things like the web browser so that you can't get lost there. And I've done this for about maybe 2 weeks now. So I did it during my ride and I've done it since this week. And it's just been feels really freeing in a way that feels I didn't expect. And it's really nice to like be bored sometimes, like where I would never be bored before. Like the other day I was standing in line at the bank and like I had nothing on my phone of interest. Like all I had was my to-do list and my email, and like there was nothing of interest there. And it's nice to kind of prune those notifications so I'm not getting constantly pinged by Slack or email or some of those other things. And it's really made a difference in my day-to-day. And like just the other day I was sitting and I was waiting in line at the coffee shop, and the only thing I had on my phone was my to-do list. So I opened up that instead of Instagram or something else, and it saw on there was call mechanic, schedule drop off car. And I just did it in line and like literally got my car scheduled from the mechanic. And that's something that I probably would have put off for another week. So there's just a lot of value in doing this, and you can always reinstall something. Like it's weird that I'm so afraid to do that. And I also don't think you should like make a big announcement and be like, hey, I'm going to be off social media for a while because I'm cool. But I just think there's a lot of value in like trying to be mindful of how we use our time in that way and not just having it get lost to something.
Totally. I agree with that so much. It's a good pick. We had very...
yeah, similar picks. I think we're both experiencing picks. A little burnout. I think that's what you can hear. It's like we're both overwhelmed. Thanks so much for listening. We will see you guys for the next episode. Actually, is pretty much a recap of this book. We are kind of hitting up the end of this book. So we'll be announcing our next book soon. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.
Peace.